Rounder Records, to me, from its inception, was always a place that I could go to for affirmation, not only affirmation of my taste in music, but introduction to new music that I maybe had never heard of or thought I would ever want to hear. But I was drawn to it, and I almost immediately had an attachment to and recognition of the quality of what Rounder Records was putting back. And I go back, if you're my age, to the founding part of it. So today, first part of a visit, finally, I had the opportunity to sit with Ken Irwin, one of the co-founders of Rounder Records. And we talk about Rounder Records and its inception, the guiding principles, if you will, in this first part of our conversation, and how it gets a fascinating story, and the mission statement, if you will, or the guiding principles we discuss about in this first session. I ask in preparation for this show and the subsequent show, which will include part two of Ken Irwin's discussion of music in general and Rounder Records, I ask him for some of the artists that he might want to feature during today's show. If you know, if you're familiar with the program at all, typically a guest will feature some music early on from the guest coming up, always in the second hour, by the way. I ask him, Ken, what would you want me to start out the program with, and maybe sprinkle throughout the program of Unreal Bluegrass to sort of celebrate or accentuate, rather, the Rounder Records influence? And he told me right away, Hazel Dickens, Joe Val, and the New England Bluegrass Boys, Gibson Brothers, Johnson Mountain Boys, J.D. Crow. But I'm very happy to have finally had a chance to sit and talk to Ken Irwin about Rounder Records. That's a legend you get to hear from Ken. Really happy to finally get a chance to sit and chat on Unreal Bluegrass with Ken Irwin. How are you, Ken?
I'm doing fine this morning. How are you, Steve?
So we're sitting here on a nice morning on what should be the cusp, I think, of what's going to be a beautiful day at Gray Fox on a Saturday. And all the music we know will be wonderful, and we think we're going to get some better weather. And what a more perfect time than that to sit and talk to Ken. I'm going to get this out of the way right away. And I've told you this before, but never on the record. And you hear this a lot, I'm certain. Rounder Records, to me, Ken, was like the lifeline to me. I always knew that if I had could get enough, you know, roll enough pennies when I was in school, and if I was going to buy an album, it was always going to be a Rounder album back. Because I knew this. Number one, if I didn't recognize the artist, I knew the taste of the people at Rounder, that I would like it or at least appreciate it, or it'd be a new window open for me into a world of music that now I love. So Rounder Records to me was that one place that I could always be certain that I would get something, that if I didn't love it right away, I knew there was a reason that it was there, and it was the decision-making process within Rounder. And I love Rounder Records. I grew up musically.
You.
I grew up musically on Rounder Records. I wasn't a child then, but I grew up musically on Rounder
Records.
We did,
too.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's right. I've seen the pictures. Everybody was younger then. So with that in mind, I want to talk a little bit about Rounder. I want to talk a little bit about, well, last year they received a big award from IBMA in Raleigh, and I think that was a good thing. And I want to talk to you a little bit about, this is a lot to cover, I want to talk to you a little bit about, as you've seen music culture around Rounder and the thing, choices you made, as you've seen it kind of not mature, but change throughout the years, a little bit about music. Well, we'll first talk a little about, this is not a new story, but it might be new for my listeners, a little bit about the early years of Rounder.
Where would you like to start?
Well, what was the idea? What, you know, how did you? I know some of the humble beginnings, but tell a little bit about some of the humble stuff.
Well, the idea came up when I was hitchhiking, and it was coming back from the Galax Fiddlers Convention in Virginia, and I first got picked up by a Lindsay, who was in the Mountain Ramblers, and who was recorded by Alan Lomax way back, and then the Mountain Ramblers seemed to win almost every year down there, or else Ted Lundy and the Southern Mountain Boys did. They sort of swapped off, and you didn't know quite who was going to win. And when he dropped us off, I was hitchhiking with a woman friend, and the next ride was with Ken and Sherry Davidson. And Ken, I found out along the way, was from Charleston, West Virginia, and he had located some musicians who had recorded in the late 20s and early 30s most notably Clark Hessinger, and had made new recordings of them, and got to his house. They decided that they didn't want to see my friend hitchhiking at night. Probably didn't care if I did or not, but they didn't want her to. So,
or maybe they didn't want her hitchhiking with you.
Right.
That's another. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So we spent the night, and the next morning they asked if we wanted to stay around for a while, and said yeah. And the idea was that we were going to visit Clark Hessinger and Billy Cox, who wrote "Sparkling Brown Eyes" that Joe Val did, and "Filipino Baby" and a number of other songs, and he had recorded in the early 30s. And so we went. That was our day. We went and visited Clark Hessinger and spent quite a while with him, and then over to Billy to see Billy Cox, and came back, had dinner, and the next morning they put us out to hitchhike on the way back. And but during the time, we saw the records they had put out by that time, and the Billy Cox was the one that stood out to me, and it was a yellow cover, and a not even a bright yellow, sort of a pale yellow, and it had like a Kodak photo, you know, just not black and white, block letters, and no liner notes. And when I got back to Boston, where I was going to school, I called up my roommate, Bill Nowlin, and I said, hey, this guy started a record company, and he didn't know anything about liner notes, and we have all these people around who are ethnomusicologists at Harvard, and he didn't know anything about graphics, and we have this friend Doug Parker who designed, his job was designing books for Boston University. Hmm. And so we said, you know, why don't we start a record label? Just the natural.
So I thought you were going to go, let's go back and give this guy some liner notes. And
right.
Instead you decided, we can do this part and figure out the other part.
Right.
Also. Okay.
So I said, why don't we start a record label?
Sure.
And there was no one there to tell us not to.
Why not?
And that's how it started. That was the
that was the
idea, the germ or whatever.
Well, do you remember the first, of course you do, the first album that you really put out under this label?
There were two first albums. Were one, 0001 was George Pegram, who was from Union Grove, North Carolina, where they have another, one of the longest lasting old-time fiddlers convention. I think the population at the time was 125, and that's where George is from. It's a two-finger banjo player, and amazing character. I think that at the time he was making his living performing on trains. He would walk through the cars and entertain as a minstrel. And the other record, which came out on the same day, was the Spark Gap Wonder Boys, which was a progressive old-time band from Cambridge who won the Union Grove Fiddlers contest. And I remember thinking, boy, you know, RCA or, would have been snapped up. And we were thrilled to find out that no one had approached them. And
was that a typical, you certainly did with them, but you also think at some point we got to get this band or this act because you knew they were so good they weren't going to be available? I mean, is that something that
That was not so, I think when we started out, it was more about documenting. There wasn't really a business sense. We had no 5-year plan. We had no 1-year plan. It was just to desire to put out some records and share music that we liked and thought was significant in some way with other people. We felt if we liked them that there'd be other people out there.
It's almost like a continuation of Alan Lomax, then, that you're going and gathering things and putting out things that you want to hear and want to, and you mentioned preserve or have those things available. It might be, is that a fair statement, you think? Or?
Well, I think he was more gathering.
Okay.
I think, especially when he was working for the Library of Congress, where his goal wasn't
just to
release
it.
And
just to preserve. You know, okay, so you rounder then came in. Okay, I got it. Yeah. We talked the other day, Ken, as I was asking about doing this, about some of the decision-making process early on. And I love the simplicity of Rounder's approach to what artist and what you were going to do. And I think you summed it up well the other day, if you can remember how your approach to, there were like two or three things that had to happen in order for you to sign an artist. And I thought it was perfect.
Yep. Well, first, we wanted to find music that we enjoyed and felt other people would and felt would hold up over time. Second, we were looking for artists that we liked, and we liked the representatives, if they had representatives. Certainly, the Spark Up Wonder Boys and George Pegram
did not
at that point. And third was to be able to break even. At the time, we were, by the time the first records came out, I think we were all living in a no-bedroom, three-alcove apartment. And
I think I've seen those pictures somewhere. I think, there they are.
Yeah, we shared. There was a mouse, a friendly mouse, who we shared until
Not a computer mouse.
One day, I think the mouse crawled over Bill's stomach while he was sleeping, and we decided to catch him, and we put him out near the railroad tracks so he could get away and have a life separate from us.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, at the time, we had very few expenses. We weren't taking salaries at all. We were just planning to put money back into the company. And initially, all of us were working and bringing money in. And we lived as a working living collective, all living in the same place.
It makes perfect sense because of I didn't know that exactly. I knew your early living expenses were, but it makes perfect sense when you say collective, because I always felt that Rounder had this greater than the sum of the parts. And that's a worn out phrase, but I really felt like there was something else going on there rather than just you brought a talent and somebody else brought a talent. I always thought there was some bigger things, and whether you all realized it at the time or not, I thought you were operating. And that explains to me a lot of it. If you were working to put money into the Rounder label.
Well, we were coming out of the 60s. It was a very political time. Okay. And we felt that what we were doing was both fun, but we also felt somewhat of a mission to record this music. It was a time that... it was after the folk boom, and most of the labels who had been recording folk music no longer were. And there was just this, you know, tons and tons of wonderful music out there that wasn't really being documented and made available.
There had to be some surprises to you in the things that you released through Rounder, not only just the ones that did really well, but were there any that you thought, I thought that would be better received? Not to be critical of those particular artists, but there had to be some that hit or miss, which is a bad description.
Yeah.
But I mean, I can think of some probably that you think, wow, that really went over much better than we thought. Probably some you thought this would be absolute, but you still were preserving and recording. But were there things that you thought in your methodology at Rounder that this was going to be a thumbs up project all the way that didn't work out that way? Or we don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. I was curious about that.
Well, we tried to be realistic, but we weren't always. Certainly we were surprised partially because we were in a little bubble. After our first bluegrass release, Joe Val and the New England Bluegrass Boys, we heard, for instance, from Walt Saunders, who is still writing for Bluegrass Unlimited, and he wrote the first review of Joe Val, and we contacted him afterwards. He referred to Jerry and Sky, who we had never heard of, who coincidentally recorded Sparkling Brown Eyes, so it's a little bit of history coming from a couple different places. And we later got in touch with Dick Spotswood, who was one of the founders of Bluegrass Unlimited, and other people who were involved in the bluegrass and old-time communities. And So when we found some artists that we thought there'd be tremendous excitement about, when we reissued the Connie and Babe record in the early days of Bluegrass series, and then found them through Ranger Doug Green, who I guess a lot of people have been looking for Connie and Babe for decades, and nobody knew who they...
You couldn't Google them.
No, couldn't Google them, and you know, most of them had white-collar jobs and were, you know, playing, I think it was every Sunday, they would play at Connie Gately's house, and they'd do homemade ice cream and pick, and that was enough. You know, they weren't, you know, if they got invited to a festival, fine, but that wasn't, it wasn't a goal. But we thought when we found Connie and Babe that there'd be tremendous excitement, and there was from Dick Spotswood,
yeah,
Walt
sure.
Saunders, Pete Kuykendall, and we thought, oh, everybody's going to be really excited. No.
but it fit all the criteria of Rounder, and you all the decision-making processes you went through, and that was enough, but I'm just always curious about those. I'm going to tell you this, and since we're sitting at a Bluegrass Festival, I was sort of in the middle of learning how to play a banjo when the J.D. Crow and the New South album came out. And at the time, it was, I won't use the word, let's put it this way, it was not a traditional sound. I won't say that it was revolutionary, it wasn't. But that was not your normal thing at all. As a matter of fact, there were people, I loved it because of the music and the instrumentality, but there were people back then who did not like that album. And now it's one of those things that, well, if you want to hear the real thing, go back to J.D. Crow and that. That's amazing transformation to me. It has to be something you look back and you say, wow, how did that happen?
Well, I think that record was not alone in that. I think the Country Gentlemen, who were considered very progressive at the time, and the Country Gentlemen were out there and they were doing Crosby, Stills, and Nash songs and tapping into a totally different repertoire. And they were considered outside. Yeah. You know, they weren't outside like the New
they
Grass Revival became.
They weren't embraced by that early community. And now they are revered. I'll use that term. But so how does that? So then let's think about today as we're sitting here. The same process occurs because human beings are the same. But do you see those changes where things that maybe weren't immediately accessible or embraced by a community, bluegrass or whatever, that are now revered because they influenced more people than anyone thought at the time, even though they weren't traditionalist based?
Well, I remember, this is slightly off center, but I think it's a very important part of Rounder and now of Bluegrass. I remember talking to people at what I think might have been the first IBMA and telling them about Alison Krauss, who at the time was... I think we started talking with her when she was 13. I think the record came out when she was 14. And I was trying to say, you know, she's a young woman, but she's really good, and trying to get people interested.
Yeah.
And now that's not even a... I mean, it is a factor. I still hear from some women that they contact a festival and they're told that we have our woman act on Friday.
Oh.
So it's not totally cleared up, but at the time that was something that really changed. And I think, you know, early on we had sort of pre-bluegrassers and Ola Bell Reed, Wimley and Wimley Cooper, Hazel and Alice, and you know, then we recorded Claire Lynch, Allison, and you know, the things have never been the same since.
No, and the result is now you have, whereas I may have been inspired by Earl or JD or Sonny, now you have all these young women players who are very well received, and their inspiration might have been that very early Allison Reed.
Yeah.
Still, so it helps allow, which it just energizes the whole music scene, and we all benefit from it because we get to hear this great music from them as a leader of a band, and it's their ideas, and what they want to put forward was always Alison Krauss and Union Station once she got started. But so now you have these bands that are that young women and even younger, a little, you know, can go up and be inspired by it. It brings up that whole other side, which I think is critical to the music continuing to move forward and be enriched, is my word for it. I think it's a wonderful thing that's happened.